So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, how podcasts are helping Spotify grow their profits, can audio help the Mail dominate online news, and where will Ben Cooper go after Radio 1? Plus, Samira Ahmed and Ofcom give the BBC more headaches, and in the media quiz, we take a look at the first reviews for Apple TV Plus and their original series. It's all to come in today's Media Podcast. And it's Rajar Week, so with grim inevitability, we welcome back the MD of Folder Media, Matt Deegan. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Nice to be here. Grim and all.
We're going to cover Rajar's later, but in the meantime, just give us an exciting Q3 radio ratings headline.
Obviously, the most exciting thing is that Fun Kids has had its best ever Rajar performance.
Yeah, funny you should pick that up.
Yes, my own radio station. I think my other fact is the hours for younger people is starting to drop precipitously.
Okay, more
of
that
later.
Later, indeed. It's like we both work in radio. Also here, we welcome back the MD of Something Else, Steve Ackerman. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Ollie.
Now, Steve, obviously the biggest event at Something Else recently has been producing the excellent episode of Archive on 4 presented by me, currently a pinned tweet at Ollie Mann. But to save both our blushes, tell me instead about Unheard, the Fred and Rose West tapes.
Well, it's not salacious as you might think. It's a podcast, I think it's episode 8 is out now. And it's basically a guy called Howard Soons, who's the journalist who first, one of the first journalists who was onto the Fred and Rose West story. He's got all his original microtapes from when he was covering the story 25 years ago. So all his interviews with lodgers and lawyers and family members. And so we're retelling the West story and particularly focusing on the victims' stories, which at the time with tabloid journalism really got ignored. They were really just a list of names. And it's a series that's doing very, very well. Both
a significant
in the UK.
Download milestone, go on.
This week, the week we're recording, it's now gone past 1 million listens. So,
congratulations.
Thank you.
And I've saved the best till last. We have a blue chip panel with us this week. It is the annual appearance of the Queen Mother of Media Punditry, journalist and Channel 4 historian Maggie Brown's here again. Hello, Maggie.
Oh, hello. It's lovely to meet not a veteran this time.
I thought I'd accelerate you to monarchy. I don't know where we go next year.
Do I have the divine right to do this?
Now, you've been at the Women in Journalism event this week, I understand.
Yes, I was on Tuesday night, yes.
Yeah, give us a taster.
Oh, it was actually really interesting because it was held in Bloomberg's European headquarters, which was really worth going to see because it was like a defensive fortress, so defensive that I couldn't find it. And none of this is actually by accident, of course, when you design these huge buildings. And it's, I think, directly influenced by 9/11 and the fact that, of course, Mayor Bloomberg was, you know, affected very much so being in New York and worried, and I think probably understood that there would be future threats to people actually just trying to do journalism of any sort, because obviously Bloomberg do financial journalism. But yes, it was a good event. It was interesting because there were very experienced women giving their, you know, knowledge and experience to perhaps lesser mortals in or aspiring journalists. And one of the things that came out, a key thing really, was that women, if they wanted to literally, you know, march up the scale and become the bosses, they're going to have to be, or very good correspondents, they're going to have to be less shrinking violets, and they're going to have to come forward. You know, if a story gets dismissed, you put up another good one. You don't sort of run away in your corner and sort of have a little weep. You have to sort of, dare I say it, man up.
Or lean in, as Sheryl Sandberg would
indeed
say.
Social media must help with that, actually, because now there are so many formal and informal groups of women journalists supporting each other, discussing each other's causes, you know, retweeting each other. That's changed, hasn't it, since when you started out?
Yes, it has. And I think that also there's a whole confidence level. And there's been a change in the past 10 years. And it's been driven too by the fact that you cannot now, for example, just have an all-male panel on a discussion show. Or if you do, you realise it's a bit wrong, or you it's a very specialist subject. So there's more equality in terms of share of voice, although obviously there are still more male voices than female voices, but all of that has improved immeasurably. I mean, one of the people on the panel was Liz Howell, who you've had on the podcast, who has actually pioneered an awful lot of the, you might call, monitoring, really, of content. So yeah, it was a good evening. I enjoyed it.
Okay, let's dive in then. We're going to talk about Ofcom's second annual review of the BBC and their findings that Auntie continues to lose younger audiences. Matt, you sort of alluded to this with radio, but this is the case across the piece.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about Ofcom's reports is they're getting quite feisty with the BBC and taking them to task over a whole range of activities. I mean, the gender, age, race is all in there. But also, you know, they got a bit of a kick for how they're doing in on-demand versus other SVOD providers like Netflix, when really it is Ofcom's fault that they're in this position. You know, broadcasters were going to work together on a thing called Kangaroo a number of years ago, at the perfect time as this was all kicking off, and they were told, no, that would be anti-competitive, and now they're getting a kick in because they're not doing so well.
But the particular stat that you're referencing there is that younger people were more likely to watch BBC content on Netflix than iPlayer. That's pretty damning, isn't it? They didn't even know that Doctor Who was a BBC show.
Well, I think they probably did know that Doctor Who is a BBC show, but they have a device and an app and a system that they consume a lot of television on, so that stuff happens to be on too, and they're not so bothered about going to the BBC's platforms.
Or may not know it's there. Even if they do know it's a BBC show, they may not have got the message yet that there's a section on iPlayer for them.
Well, also, I think one of the big problems for BBC television is it's been programmed so that its average age is in the 50s for BBC One and BBC Two.
60s so, now.
Yeah, and so if all that programming is doing very well for that audience and probably keeping up BBC's total share in television, it's no great surprise that young people aren't going to go to the on-demand platform for the service that mainly reaches people in their late 50s.
And then you take BBC Three, you know, off of the actual broadcaster palette that you're offering, and I think that that's a big loss too.
It is, and they say all the BBC Three content is on BBC One, but again, it's on a channel which, you know, predominantly people aren't consuming, and we're in a world where you know, we schedule our TV and radio stations by knowing kind of what they do. I think absolutely it's the BBC's job to fix these things. It's also Ofcom's part of their problem that they caused.
But also possibly to grow some hits, I guess, because, I mean, a lot's been made of RuPaul's Drag Race. I mean, for a start, that's being advertised not really as a BBC Three show, but on iPlayer. And secondly, it's not a BBC show, is it? It's a World of Wonder show that's been on American telly for over a decade. Why don't they just make their own?
Absolutely, but I think this is the problem they've got themselves into, is they've got no spaces to broadcast this. They've lost any channels to do this job. And this is why radio, you know, and BBC Sounds, and why the big push is there. Pretty much radio and audio has to do all the heavy lifting for BBC as organisation to reach young people.
So do you think actually, Maggie, we're going to end up seeing the BBC doing a BBC Sounds but for telly? There is a revamp of iPlayer in the pipeline, isn't there? And maybe it will be focused around new content aimed at young people you can't get elsewhere.
Well, I just don't know. I mean, if I could just pick you up, Matt, on one point, though. This kind of chastising of the BBC over not, you know, catering for younger people, this has been Ofcom's attack on Channel 4, really, for the past decade, before it came into the area of regulating or overseeing the BBC too. And yes, the BBC are pretty annoyed, actually, with Ofcom one way or another. And I would also add that if you look at Ofcom's, somebody, not me, but somebody needs to actually do a proper examination of the way Ofcom operates, because it is actually still quite a young regulator. And all I know is from my history of Channel 4 that Ofcom makes mistakes. It wasn't actually necessarily backing, opposed to the Kangaroo platform. That was really a competition issue, which was probably wrong. But there has been this constant nagging, really, about younger audiences, while at the same time expecting the BBC to be all things to all people. My view is that a lot depends on whether the licence fee is sorted out, this over 75s issue. If they don't somehow get back the money that they were expecting to get from government, then they're in for very, you know, meagre rations. If, and I've heard quite a bit about this, if there can be a deal done once we get over Brexit, once we get past the election, once people start talking about policy properly, once we have a culture secretary who's around for more than a couple of months.
Well, Nicky Morgan's stepping out of politics completely.
That's right.
Yeah.
So if that happens, there's a lot of ifs, but I have heard very good conversations that there can be some sort of fix on this, then maybe the BBC can stretch its wings a bit.
Or maybe they need to take bigger steps. I mean, Steve, one of the things Nicky Morgan was musing about publicly was the idea that the licence fee becomes a subscription. I think most people would acknowledge that's sort of always been on the table, but in like 40 years' time. But might we see that sooner than expected?
I just think that's probably a very, very slippery slope in terms of if we genuinely believe that there is some sort of role in the production of content for the BBC, then to go down a subscription route clearly just starts to make it another service. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the right move. I mean, I think if you want to talk about big steps the BBC should be taking, we all know that historically it is the TV people and the channel controllers who have dominated the politics and the landscape at the BBC to the expense of online content and to the expense of radio. And that has to change. And my understanding is there is a big argument brewing and a big fight coming between the role of iPlayer and the people who are leading iPlayer and the role of channels and where they might stand. And obviously it gets to the heart of this issue, which is that older audiences are consuming through the channels and younger audiences aren't.
And we've seen that in radio, haven't we? It's going to play out in, you know, you hear people who work for Radio 4 complaining their budget's gone to BBC Sounds. That's going to be as nothing to what happens when the controller of BBC One gets upset.
That'd be nice if BBC Sounds was a bit better organised as well. They've made a sort of an error somehow in this. Everybody always does this when they relaunch an online site. They always get it wrong. I mean, Channel 4 changed 4AD to All 4 instead of putting 4 All on. You know, it just is a sort of muddle at the moment.
That's coming with Sounds, though, I think, because Jonathan Wall is in there now and he's got obviously a track record of working with a sort of small dynamic team because he used to head up 5 Live. And I know that he's already getting in place, much more great organisation. But obviously it just gets to the heart of audience behaviours and you keep coming back to the same point, which is once you get an on-demand habit, why would you ever switch back to that idea of just turning on the telly and hoping you're going to find something, or just turning on the radio and hoping you're going to find something? It's not going to happen. It's not the logical direction of travel.
But Steve, what they need to do, though, is they have to then invest in the actual technology more, because we all know it's a delight to use Netflix as opposed to iPlayer. Now, let's be honest about it. You know, the Netflix experience is extremely seductive, but that's because they really, really, really work on the technology and you don't get a buffering, and they've managed to find... And I see the latest
thing... the entire programming budget for the BBC just on technology, wouldn't it?
I'm just trying to point out that if they do get some compensation or something changes with the over 75s issue, then they would have resources to put into that as opposed to content. But this is a problem that is across all of the domestic efforts to do online sites. It's not just a BBC problem.
And the iPlayer leads... In terms of domestic sites, the iPlayer, let's not forget, the iPlayer is still a very good platform and does lead the way, but you're right, it's up against some really, really challenging competition.
Well, and also it's that transition from being a catch-up service to being a destination. And they've always had trouble defending one and going into another area.
Can we talk about what Ofcom said about BBC News as well, which was essentially... journalists on air need to be more willing to call out lies and challenge extreme views, basically saying this idea of balance gets too overly imposed.
Well, they say they should be neutral, really. That's what one of the rulings is over the Naga Manchetti situation. And it is interesting because I They're also saying that younger people, if they want to be, if the BBC wants to be engaging them, like gritty stuff. They like views and they like things which stand out. And some of these things do run counter to the BBC culture, which is to try to be measured and balanced. And I think it's nothing to do with this issue. I think television is a very difficult medium in which to discuss complicated political ideas. And it's a spoken medium or it's a visual medium. And in some ways, the best way to actually work out what is going on is to read proper newspapers or to read the documents. I think it's really hard to be informed at the moment about what we're being offered in Brexit. So I feel the BBC gets a bit caught up in that. But yes, of course, it is too anodyne. Its coverage is on under attack from both sides, and I don't think that necessarily means that its output is in the right place.
But isn't there a fundamental point, which is that it's quite right you should strike a balance on an issue where there are two genuine points of view. So, you know, obviously the abortion, classic example. You know, you may not agree with the other side, but there are two genuine points of view. When you get something like climate change and you have Nigel Lawson on the Today programme, who is a climate change denier and just talking nonsense, and all the science is there to show that this thing is happening, that's not a balanced issue. That's not a point of let's show the other side, because the other side is factually incorrect.
Which is what the Ofcom report says. But the problem is, Matt, if you're a presenter on the BBC, you've got a lot going on. You've got people speaking in your ear. You've got to represent the values of the BBC. You've got to digest the news and present it in a way that's accessible and entertaining and all the rest of it. And then at the same time, you're now supposed to be thinking, is this an issue where I don't have to be balanced? Mm. Do I have to say the counterexample thing, or do I actually say, no, you're wrong? It's a lot to expect of a journalist sitting there on telly, not writing an article, but live in the moment.
But also, I think that the shift is also because we're in a much more divisive society now, particularly driven by Brexit. And also, consumers of media, particularly the noisy ones who are on Twitter and the social platforms, are used to having more specialised views. So there's a lot of people who just assume that if you are independent or trying to strike a balance, you're lying. You know, you are withholding your view, and that actually secretly in what you've said, you're attacking one side or undermining the other. And I think that's the problem, is that people are assuming that successful, talented journalists are cheating with what they're saying. And then you look at something like LBC, and I think you have Ian Dale, who is, you know, stood to be an MP, is right wing. However, because
media podcast regular,
yeah, but because you know that, you can make a judgment about what he's saying. And I think it's I think a lot of people feel that is more honest because you understand them as a human being, and staying in the middle perhaps just doesn't scale to a more complex digital world.
But for example, do you really think, is Nigel Farage going to be allowed to have his position in commercial radio?
No, obviously? I mean, because...
During an election?
During an election. No. The answer to that is no, right?
Yeah, as of today, he'll be off air and for the 6 weeks.
And I don't know if he's standing as an MP, is he, Nigel Farage?
He hasn't announced whether he's doing it.
But even if he hasn't announced, just the fact he's leader of the Brexit Party, that disqualifies him from broadcasting.
I'd need to double check the rules.
That's what I don't understand.
Because
I think commercial radio has really changed the climate on what's acceptable under our so-called impartiality rules. And I listen and I think, goodness. And it's also a question of where these presenters are placed in the schedule as well. You know, they're not being buried late at night. They're right in your face when people are maybe driving around in cars, you know, going on journeys. So I think that has completely changed the atmosphere. And so has actually the Nagamanchetti decision, which has rocked the BBC, because it appears to say that on morning shows, maybe, you know, Good Morning Britain, for example, you can have opinionated people. The best guidance is actually rational scepticism. That is the phrase I've heard. Rational scepticism of all views.
We'll be back with more media news after this.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of the Media Podcast was recorded at Spiritland Studios in London's King's Cross. Spiritland Studios are run by Spiritland Productions, providers of professional audio solutions to TV, radio and online. As well as their broadcast standard studio facilities, Spiritland Productions also has a world-class OB vehicle for audio and video projects of any scale. Whether it's podcasting, outside broadcasting or live concert recording, produce your next show with Spiritland Productions. Just go to spiritlandproductions.com now. Well, it's not just our panel that's a blue-chip reminder of the Guardian Media Talk days. Like back then, we are doing a hefty chunk on the BBC, so I'm going to move us on to the next BBC story so I can get through as many as we can, which is that the Radio 1 controller Ben Cooper has announced his departure from the network. A brief obit for him, Steve, and what do you think has prompted him to go?
So Ben has been the controller of Radio 1 for, I think, something like 8 years, maybe something like that. He previously held various sort of producer and editorial roles at Radio 1. He'd had a stint at Capital as well. So long-term radio person, clearly someone who's very passionate about the radio. I think there's probably a couple of things. First of all, a bit earlier in the year, you may recall that Lorna Clark got appointed as, I think her title was something like Head of Pop. But
Controller
basically,
of Pop, I believe.
Controller of Pop. But in effect, that is a role above the controller of Radio 1, and I don't know this as fact, but I would be amazed if Ben hadn't gone for that role, and clearly he didn't get chosen. I think the other thing is, look, Radio 1 is a youth station. It is having to move at a faster pace than ever before. I don't know exactly how old Ben is, but I think he's probably late 40s, something like...
I think he's
like,
49.
Right, so I would imagine that you know, the other issue is just that Radio 1, as we've just been debating with the TV channels, is facing real, real challenges. And Ben probably looked at it and has looked at his expertise and the demand for audio professionals that there is now because of things like podcasting. And he's probably thought, OK, I think I can have a good chance of picking up a very nice role somewhere else.
Well, OK, where do we think he's going to go, briefly?
I don't know, but I mean, if you look at previous controllers in music stations at the BBC, they usually go into the music production industry.
Well, I think Apple or Spotify seem to be the obvious places
Apple or Spotify, but obviously the other option these days could potentially be any other big podcast operator, one of the big American podcast companies, who knows?
He's very effective.
Yes, he's a good operator.
But it shows how the industry's changed, doesn't it, Matt, that we're not saying he's going to go to Bauer or Global, which would have been 20 years ago, the equivalent of those places would be the obvious place. You've got a career at
the
BBC.
That's where the presenters go, not the executives.
Yeah.
Yes, it's always been difficult at BBC to commercial radio change because they are so different as organisations. Yes, they share some frequencies, but how they work is almost entirely different.
And on another BBC story, Maggie, they are fighting a pay dispute claim from Samira Ahmed.
Yes.
Outline that for us.
Well, Samira Ahmed is a very experienced journalist. She was at Channel 4, but she has most recently been doing two spots, really, for the BBC. And she is saying that she has been seriously underpaid at £425 a week, yes, for a 15-minute slot called Newswatch, which really is on the BBC News channel, but which gets dropped into the Sunday breakfast show as well. Mm. And the problem for her is that the person who does points of view or has done points of view when she was basically doing her job was Jeremy Vine, and he was originally getting £3,500 for points of view.
And the BBC's argument is that isn't gender discrimination. That's a sort of BBC One News Channel issue. It's that points of view is an entertainment show. Newswatch is a news show. She's getting paid the same as the previous male presenter of Newswatch.
Ray Snoddy. Actually, I emailed Ray to see what he thought about this, but he hasn't replied, which I thought was a bit sad. But I actually think she's trying it on a bit, really. I admire her bravery, but there is a difference between a news channel programme commissioned for a news channel, which gets a repeat, and what might be a high octane, basically entertainment information show. Also, big breath. She Jeremy Vine is a star. That's the fact of the matter. He has a much higher profile. I've listened to him actually on Channel 5. He's my little weakness. And I also quite like, I like him very much on radio too. I mean, he has a lightness and he has a wit, and he's just a very, very accomplished broadcaster in every area as far as I'm concerned. And I think that that may account for the difference. But anyway, he's not there now because, as we know, now the BBC... What's happened at the BBC is that for two decades, its pay policies have been actually very, very muddled. And I include the people right at the top who were, remember, getting bonuses in the 90s, infuriating the politicians. You've got presenters, some of whom, very few now remain, but who could command whatever their agents could get for them. And everything has changed, really. Plus, of course, there's this big issue, yes, of being fair between people, you know, equal pay for people doing equal jobs. So I think she's brave, but I'm not. I'd be surprised if she wins.
The argument behind the headline, though, would be, you're right, Jeremy Vine is sort of objectively a bigger star than Samira Ahmed, but her point is no woman was allowed to be as big a star as Jeremy Vine in a scenario where the head presenters, the big money went to big male names, and therefore that in itself is a kind of gender discrimination.
Well, I mean, Anne Robinson used to do very well. I don't know.
On points of view, in fact.
Mm. Yeah, that's my whole point. I mean, I would say, but she also had other slots, you know. I think that there is a difference between people who are genuine big stars and people who are not. And this is just an unfortunate fact that the BBC also happens to be in show business as well as in public service broadcasting.
The other difficulty with it, which you touched on a little bit, is it's not just about the sort of size of the star. She's saying that, in effect, the show she was doing was basically the same sort of content as Points of View, and therefore that's why it should be paid the same. And that obviously throws up all sorts of issues because you know, where does that stop in terms of apples and pears? You can completely see in the Carrie Gracie case, she was a correspondent in China and she was complaining, I'm not being paid the same as, you know, the special correspondents in America. And so you can say, okay, yes, you can see that that is in effect the same job, and there is clearly a very strong case there. I think there's a real nuance around this that is very, very different. And I agree with Maggie. I mean, I think we all agree with the principle of equal pay, but this feels like it's not quite a fair comparison. I think.
You'd imagine...
though, how the hell was Jeremy Vine being paid £3,500 for a programme that no one bloody watches?
Like a points of view letter.
We've had a letter from Steve Ackerman, and he says he's had a
why,
how much
oh,
on
why, pays. Oh, why? Yeah, I mean, I imagine Claudia Winkleman gets paid a lot more for doing the film programme on BBC One when she did that.
And Gary Lineker.
I was going to say, than whoever hosts the Mark Kermode thing on the news channel. Yeah. I don't even know who that is. I'm Faceless Anchor. Mm. I mean, they're completely different, but it's the same content, isn't it?
This is, you know, Simon Mayo's moved out, Jeremy Vine has moved out or diversified, and we've got John Humphreys apparently doing something for Channel 5 now.
Oh, and Classic FM. Did you hear him do the breakfast show on Classic FM?
I did.
And, you know,
what did you make of it?
You could tell he was a little bit nervous doing it.
Which is quite nice.
Yes, and I think what was interesting was when you strip out all the politics, you realise he's got a great radio voice and actually is pretty well suited to Classic FM as he gradually gets up to speed on all the pronunciations and the style of the station.
Okay, let's move on from the BBC, please, and talk about online streaming. Spotify's Q3 results are in. They revealed some interesting data. Matt, what did we learn?
We learned that Spotify are doing... they made a big investment into the podcast space earlier this year. They acquired three companies, Gimlet Media, Parcast, and Anchor, two of those being content companies. They were already making some of their own material. And what they've decided, seemingly, is they're an audio system, not just a music app. And they are keen to have everything that goes into people's ears going through Spotify. But what they issued their quarterly reports, but kind of buried in the data was information that if people listen to podcasts through Spotify, they're more likely to convert to paying subscribers of the service. And that's kind of interesting, and that's where their money comes from. There is an ad-funded product in Spotify, and the podcasts have done okay with their ad money, and that's growing at quite a clip. But it's still dwarfed by the subscription revenue. So if podcasting is merely a way to get new subscribers, it seems to be the right thing for them to do.
And Steve, as a podcast producer, how do you feel about that? You know, Spotify are crowing, saying, oh, look, we can use podcasts to leverage our users to subscribe to premium and give us more money. So what? It doesn't help you, does it? You're not people like your show. Well, and they're giving Spotify more money to hear it. Is that right?
No, but where it clearly helps podcasting is the investment that they are putting into podcasting. Don't forget, this isn't just about them buying the companies they bought for significant amounts of money. They're also investing in original titles. So in effect, they're becoming a commissioner and they're buying existing shows. So successful podcasters are being made offers by Spotify to take their titles over to Spotify. So there's a big all-round investment going in from them.
And you see my point. The users are basically paying. Upgrading to premium means I'm paying you to take away the ads that are annoying me.
In the music.
The ads
will still be in the podcast.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The inbuilt ads will still be in the podcast.
But as a podcaster, that doesn't impact on me.
But the people who are making a financial contribution aren't lining your pockets. They're lining a third party's pockets as a result of ads that you haven't injected.
Whilst that is true, that they're also paying for a system of marketing which alerts people to listen to our material. And it is, as a podcast provider, I'm very happy that there are a number of competitive apps out there, as well as Apple and Spotify and other things. And I want them all to be competitive because they have a better chance of not locking me in some content dungeon and getting me out to potential.
You couldn't have a podcast ceremony, could you? Awards ceremony.
Ah, yes.
You didn't have lots of podcasts.
Otherwise known as the Content Dungeon Awards. let's talk about Ray Jars now. And good news for Bauer's Kistery. Maggie, I imagine you're a big listener to Kistery.
Certainly not. but I'm actually really, really pleased to see commercial radio doing so well. I mean, I think when I said earlier that regulators make a hash of things very often, I think regulators made a total hash of radio in the 90s. And it's good to see national brands being created, LBC going national, for example. I mean, LBC was completely beaten up by the regulatory system. It's managed to survive and come through. So, no, I'm quite happy. And you're naturally going to see... You can't have win the whole time. The BBC is still in a very, very, very strong position as a broadcaster in this country in all areas. So it's inevitable as commercial radio really gets its act together, which I'm sorry to say it's taken too long, but it's there. You're going to find challenges. You're going to find digital channels that really outstrip them. And that's how it should be. That's competition for you.
And those sort of niche spin-off network channels are doing well, aren't they? So it's a Kistery Absolute 80. As well, doing well, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, so to speak, so something like Kistery, over 2 million listeners listening to Kistery. You know, it's the biggest digital station. In some markets, it's sort of neck and neck with the main KISS. You know, they found a thing that works, which is dance gold, for want of a better description, and are doing very well. You're seeing that with Heart and Heart 80s and Heart 90s. Global have just launched a whole suite of new national spin-off services based on their big brands because they've seen huge both reach growth, but more importantly, hours growth, as it's the hours and total hours that provides the commercial impacts that these beasts can monetize.
How did Scala do, though? Because that was actually a bold new idea, wasn't it? Classical music for young people. That doesn't seem to cut through as much.
Yes, they had a little drop on their opening radio, and so they're around 230,000. I think they know it's a big build. I'm sure they would have liked it to be a little larger. I think they'd probably say that Simon Mayer was off air for much of that quarter. And I think there's some telly to come to promote it. But also it does show just shoving a station national doesn't mean instant success. And the things connected to brands are the things that have done much better. Because it is much easier to introduce something that is a spin-off from something people know and love than to start from scratch.
And rather depressingly, for people who liked their local radio station back in the day, more vindication for the networking strategy, isn't there? Where I think I'm right in saying that the combined ratings for the Heart Breakfast Show is more than all of the individual hearts added up used to be.
Yeah, so I'd add a caveat to that in that a lot of the local stations, because they're smaller, have their radar measured annually in rolling quarters, as well you know.
It's the kind of detail we like on this show.
So it's perhaps not a total view on those shows yet. But I think there's a good point, which is particularly for the pop radio stations that are, you know, pop and entertainment, Jamie and Amanda on Heart, it's a very listenable show. I think she's really good. And it's different to what the local stations delivered, but it's high quality and I can see it doing pretty well.
And despite us talking about the BBC sort of failing with young people earlier, maybe a glimmer of hope in Greg James's ratings on Radio 1, they're up.
Yes, Greg James doing well. Look, I mean, he's clearly connecting with an audience, so good for him. I think Radio 1 on the whole continues to sort of find it quite tough going. I'm sort of looking to Max, he's much more the expert than me, but yeah, I think I saw that.
So it sort of drifts around this sort of 9.2 to 9.7 million listeners, and it's at the lower end 9.3 million at the moment. I think that's a reach figure, so that's people listening to 5 minutes of Radio 1 in a week. And I think... yeah, there are lots of competition. We've talked about those spin-off stations. People can have a very good youthful radio experience without Radio 1, which you couldn't do even 10 years ago. And so they're always going to find it a challenge. I think the big shift, as I mentioned earlier, was about hours. And younger audiences and reach actually has held up pretty well. There's around the same amount of people that listen to 1524s, listen to radio 10 years ago, listen to it today. But the amount they listen has changed. And that comes from being at a point where free music entertainment was only provided by the radio, which, of course, is not the case now. So I don't think it's any great surprise that young people listen less to it, and we should be very pleased that they listen it in their volumes. But that's a big challenge for commercial groups that are built on that hours. Mm. So if you see, if you look at the share in London, which is what a lot of people look at, LBC is kind of been at the top for the last few quarters, and Classic's actually doing quite well. The Hearts and the Capitals and the Kisses have been drifting, and Heart and Magic doing better. And that's because there isn't the volume of listening from younger audiences there used
to be. That's what interests me, actually, because I always thought Radio 1 was basically a channel that, or a radio station that appealed to younger people outside of London. Mm. And Greg sounds to me very sort of quite posh, actually, for Radio 1. Maybe this, I shouldn't say this.
But he's quite metropolitan, isn't he? Like, yes. He's very much, the joke is, I'm university educated and I'm ironising it.
I don't know what the research shows, whether Radio 1 is still very much, say, for the Manchester or the Birmingham kids, you know?
I know internally at Radio 1 they work quite hard to have voices which represent a lot of the areas. Mm. And they ran a great contest last week, a sort of treasure hunt, and they did that in England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, with voices from each of those places being kind of champions for their winners. Mm. As they think about it more, it'll be interesting to look at how Greg does outside of the camp.
He's very different to Greg, Chris Moyles, that's what I
read. He is, and Grimmy as well. I think it's... in some ways, it's a more traditional radio listen, what Greg does, but it's a much more consistent listen. I think that's why he's doing well.
And finally, on the radio thing, new station from LBC, LBC News. Has anyone dipped into that yet?
Had a listen on launch day. So LBC News is a 20-minute roll.
Yeah.
So if you tune in...
all your headlines in 20 minutes, every 20 minutes. That's basically it, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Except when there's breaking news. And there's been a bit of that this week. And they will take parliamentary debates, and it's presented live, and they've got access to pretty good resources now, so that they can do a good job of it. It's really pacey, so it's really well done. And I think if I was the BBC a bit, I'd look at that and think, this is an obvious thing we should have done somewhere.
I remember saying to you on this show before, Steve Ackerman, that Five Live, like they have a sports extra, should have a news extra. They could have done this 5 years ago, run PMQs in full, done press conferences, because it's just so irritating when the bloody rugby's on.
Well, the interesting thing is, this is, and I hope Maggie will nod and confirm to me, but this is basically the same thing that a previous incarnation of LBC tried probably, 15 years ago, maybe?
Yes, exactly.
And obviously it's taken from a US format. I mean, the BBC, the truth is, I think particularly with radio stations, has always been slow to innovate. You know, they didn't launch an Asian network until there was a commercial version. They didn't launch Five Live until Talk Radio was going. Mm. So, yeah, there may be a case for that.
And there's always this conflict, as you say, when there's really big sport and big news on at the same time. It's not beyond the wit of them, really.
I mean, from conversations I've had, I think they would like Five Live to be two digital radio stations. Mm. And I think they've they've had conversations to try and make that happen, but face some regulatory challenges from it. And I imagine particularly from TalkSport, with TalkSport 2, and now with from Global for LBC and LBC News. And I think that they have missed the boat. Where they are doing something interesting is they have a new Alexa News app, which is a bit different to other ones, where you can kind of query for more information and kind of skip headlines, and you know, maybe a more non-traditional news service is the way to go.
But I like the fact that Alexa wasn't being used very much when I read the Radar reports. And I mean, I've turned my Alexa off, and it says, you know, nobody's really, it's not growing listening on via Alexa.
Well, it's not when people fill out a pen and paper diary to search.
Yeah, no, I think people, so about a third of Alexa, so I'm trying to remember this, I think a third of listening on Alexa is to radio. So it's like the second or third most popular thing to do on the device. But interestingly, it's 55 pluses that really do that. About 60% of their listening through Alexa is to radio. So as a radio broadcaster, I love it as a device because it's another radio that's out there. But the challenge for radio stations and Alexa is there's no way to choose a station other than say the name. So you need to have a brand to have consumption.
Okay, let's talk now about the latest shenanigans at Mail Online. Mail Plus, where have they got that name from? Everything's a plus, isn't it? A premium service which includes a daily radio show, sounds like a podcast to me, and also a weekly podcast, is being launched by the tabloid. Matt, what's the big idea?
So I think Mail Plus has sort of existed anyway for a little while, but they're basically souping it up and making it a bit more digital is how I understand it. So there's more in the app. They're trying to cultivate their subscribers more than just giving them a digital version of the paper. There's a lot of audio in there as well, which is all available online. I did some Google searching of lots of different words together and found all their pilots.
Oh, right.
They've been practicing this since about May. Lots of different shows, many of which they haven't announced, that I perhaps will not see the light of day. So the audio seemingly is quite a big push for them. Andrew Pearce is going to present this daily radio show.
But it's daily at a set time.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's why it's not a podcast.
Yeah.
And that's why it feels like maybe a slight, I don't know, I mean, I think from an audio perspective, maybe a slightly backwards step.
I don't know why they're doing it.
Well, it feels like when The Sun did their radio station, doesn't it? Which basically didn't work.
Yes. Well, you know, are there any successful internet radio stations in the UK that operate like businesses? No.
Yeah.
So that would suggest that it's not the right thing to do.
But branded Mail will work,
and
right?
It will become a podcast.
Yeah.
And there's an Amanda Platel podcast, and there's some stuff around art.
Michael Crick as well, doing a video series for...
And I don't know whether it will make... the problem is there's so much good quality free podcast content from right and left and whatever your predilection is. I'm not sure an Amanda Platel-led show and others are going to build desirable subscription base as much as they would perhaps like them to.
But they will, I think, promote it through their newspaper, which is pretty well read, isn't it? And the other thing is, this is really a big push by the editor, Geordie Gregg, and he's put his deputy, who's a very capable person, Tristan Davis, onto it. And so I'm sure there'll be masses of changes. No newspaper ever gets this sort of thing right first time round, maybe not second time round, but I bet you they will go on throwing resources at it because they know they have to do something.
And they're a bit behind in audio.
Very much so.
I don't imagine Paul Dacre will be listening though.
But News UK have done the same thing. Obviously they have Wireless Studios who are basically there to create podcasts out of all the, you know, the Times and the Sun and all the News UK titles. They've used their titles and their radio stations to promote their podcasts and have still struggled to have podcast hits.
The odd thing, I think, is that a big lesson of the last few years is that, I mean, LBC have shown this, for example, that if you have your branding in big letters behind a provocateur, then it'll go on Facebook. And even if people don't click it and listen, they see your brand. I find it odd that News UK are good at that when it comes to talk radio and talk sport, but they haven't done it with the Times. They don't seem to videos the stuff of the Sun. And I wonder if Mail Online, actually, what they're trying to do is just get, instead of Andrew Pearce sitting on Good Morning Britain, just have him sitting in front of a Daily Mail logo, and that's it doesn't matter whether anyone listens to it or not.
I think also it's part of having an offer. So here is a reason to subscribe, even if you never actually listen to it. But, you know, I will give my $4.95 a month or whatever it is.
But I mean, the Daily, that's the one they all want to be, isn't it? The New York Times
Daily
podcast.
But what people don't understand about the Daily is...
how much it costs?
It's very well resourced.
Yeah.
There's like 27 people that work on the Daily.
Well, and also, don't forget the history of the Daily is it was almost an accident. You know, they started experimenting with a much smaller team and suddenly found that there was an audience for it and they were making you know, eight-figure sums out of it.
Sticking with the Mail, Maggie, they're one of the likely suitors for the Daily Telegraph again, aren't they?
Yes, indeed.
So the Barclay brothers are putting the Telegraph up for sale. Potentially they're going to get a lot less than they paid for it.
Well, they paid £660 million or something for it in 2004.
And a free bottle of Buxton. who else is in the running, do you think?
Well, I mean, you've always got hopefuls that you... I mean, people think Jeff Bezos, but I can't really see why you'd want it. I think also there's the... A former editor of the Daily Mirror, whose name is escaping me, and I can't remember. David Montgomery, yes, who's got what's it called, National World, and he's always up for a bargain. So we don't really know. The Barclays are so secretive. You don't really know what they want to do either, apart from offloading a paper that, alas, is just scraping into just under £1 million of profit a year. I hope it goes to somebody responsible because it's a sad. Sort of morbid paper, I feel, compared with the Daily Telegraph used to be a proper newspaper in the 80s. It used to do news properly. And in fact, that survived under Max Hastings, really. And I think it's just lost its way completely over the past decade.
But who would... I mean, clearly whoever would buy it would feel that they can get a bargain and that they can try and turn it round as a business. But on a fundamental basis... The newspaper model is now broken and is only going in one direction. And so, from that perspective, I'm sort of interested, Maggie, in terms of who you know, why anyone would believe at this point in time it is a business model that can still reap rewards. As you say, the dive in the profits is astonishing.
Well, I mean, the way forward really is somebody who's got very deep pockets to invest properly and heavily in the journalism, and to erect a paywall so that people will pay for it alongside advertising in it.
And do you think in the general public the brand does mean something?
Well, certainly
you have
means
an idea
a lot.
It means quality journalism.
Also, remember,
if we
end up with a right-wing, Brexit-loving government, then it will be kind of right on tune. And it has had it does still break stories. And wrapped into it is, of course, The Spectator, which I'm absolutely certain somebody would buy because it's always been a rich man's toy, really. I don't know what the future holds. I don't know what the price is. We've seen the way the Daily Express was subsumed into another group. And that's really also what's been happening in the regional press. So the obvious suitor would appear to be the Daily Mail, who did want to buy it because they are in the newspaper business. But whether they, under the current ownership and management, really want to dive deeper into a very expensive and probably loss-making paper is just another matter. But I hope I do hope that all the people in the Shires who still like to read their obituaries and all the rest of it, I hope that somehow it does find a new owner.
There just aren't enough Major Tuftons left to buy it. I think one of the problems is it's something like it turned over 260 million quid and it made like 1.6 million. I mean, literally, why bother? Why bother doing any of it?
Well, influence, though, is the one word answer to that.
It is. And that's the to me, the only buyer is someone who wants just to be able to ring up the Prime Minister and have tea.
And if Lebedev hadn't already got the Standard and now this was up for sale, he'd rather have the Telegraph.
Well, yeah, I don't know whether he's got any money left at the moment to do those things.
That's only going to wane the influence as the numbers keep on going down. And I suppose I wonder whether the issue for the Telegraph with an older demographic is, yes, you would have thought you start to go behind a paywall, you start to do more online content. But for an older demographic, that's not a natural place to go for content. So you've got to really reinvent the brand to make it to give it a much wider appeal. And as you say, at the moment, I think it's almost verging on being a toxic brand.
But, you know, one of the interesting things about that whole debate about the BBC and their news coverage is that when they look at who reads the online versions of news, it's older people. So it's not as if... people over 60, for example, are not on the internet and are not actually accessing news other than a newspaper. But the fact is other people, older people, also like to read things. And it comes back to my point about almost democracy, that if you really want to understand things, you do need to read proper.
There will be a Maggie Brown manifesto after the publication of this podcast. I'm interrupting you, Maggie, because I want to steer you on to your specialist subject to make sure there's time for this. You've got 3 minutes to talk about Channel 4 launching its creative hub in Glasgow.
Channel 4 ball.
Were you there?
Yes, I was there, and it was very interesting. It was a little bit of a misnomer because, in fact, they are opening a national headquarters in Leeds. That is perfectly true. And it is a year after they announced their decision to do so. And there will be a largish number of people there. 300 jobs are being created.
I feel a buck coming.
But at the moment, they're still waiting for the headquarters that they've chosen, which is this rather wonderful building called the Majestic. If you've ever been in Leeds, you come out of the railway station and there it is. And it used to have a number of things. It was a nightclub and all the rest of it. So they had to have their party in a very trendy bar, which was fine. And the big wigs came along. And it's quite clear that there's a whole move in that region. It's Bradford as well. People from Newcastle, they're all hoping that this can be a real moment of regeneration for the television and the media industries there. And there are a number of quite, you know, interesting things that are going through or will be going through Leeds. And then this week, of course, they trumpeted the fact that they are also opening in properly in Glasgow now, where a number of commissioners are being placed. And of course, the same will happen in Bristol. So there are three.
The controller is still going to be in London, or is she going to go to Leeds?
Well,
not commuting, but is she actually going?
The person who, well, what they're doing is they're putting commissioners and money into these places, or that's the theory. So, for example, the head of drama, which is not one of the biggest areas actually in Channel 4 in terms of their overall output, Caroline Hollick, she is based in Leeds and she will go down to London. I think what you have to remember about Channel 4 is only 850 people. All the commercial side of it, the business side, is really staying in London because they're 95% dependent on advertising. If they don't run that side of it properly, there isn't a Channel 4. But they are. What's happened basically over the past 10, 15 years is that there's been a lot of cheating about regional productions, which really have not been regional productions.
And so, such as?
Well, you know, where you appear to be planting a production team to make a programme, but actually you import all the people who can do it.
So Grand Design's being made in Amersham.
Well, that's actually outside of the M25, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's all right. So
yeah, but they're all commuting from London because it's on the Metropolitan line.
Yes. So it depends. You have to show, you know, where people live now. Yes. And indeed, one of the first big commissions which Channel 4 have made under their new guys is going to be made by Expectations, which is the new indie, rather, being run by Peter Fincham. And, you know, it's a rather sort of... Tim Hinks, it's a sort of a London-based metropolitan group who know what they're doing, but with an outpost or a partner in Leeds. So they have to find hits that are generated outside of London as well, and that's the big question for them now. I think they'll probably do it.
Okay, there is just time for our legendary media quiz. reviews are in for the first original production from Apple TV Plus. And they're not great. I'm going to give you the headline to a review of the morning show. You just have to spot the missing word from the headline. You're buzzing with your name when you know the answer. So Maggie, you will say...
Maggie.
Matt, you'll say...
Matt.
And Steve, you'll say...
Steve.
Great. Let's go. Here's headline number one. Jennifer Aniston can't save Apple's what and what debut drama? What are the missing words? Buzzing with your name when you know the answer.
Steve. Hit Newsroom.
Hit and Newsroom debut drama. No, Rudderless and Dull was the answer. Ben Travers at IndieWire.com. Here's review number two. Fraught with what about what it is and who it's for?
Steve. Confusion.
I like that you're playing the game, Steve. You're in with a chance of winning.
I only play to win, Ollie.
But the answer was no. The answer was anxiety. Fraught with anxiety about what it is and who it's for.
Half a point for confusion. Come on, let's
said Adam White at The Independent. And here is question number three. It's all to play for. Apple TV Plus rises, but doesn't what? With starry new drama.
Matt.
Yeah, Matt.
Saw.
Oh, you're so close. Come
Steve.
On. Steve.
Shine.
Yes! Deservedly, Steve has won the quiz. That was Ellen Sepinwall's review for Rolling Stone. Have Apple underestimated how hard it is to make telly?
Yes.
Great, that's the end of the show.
Like all digital companies going to a different sector, people who watch television or listen to the radio think they can make it. And guess what? It's slightly harder than it seems.
But... are you going to be watching Apple TV Plus? Because for a long time, we've all been discussing, oh, you know, room in our wallets and in our minds for another subscription.
It's very cheap.
Well, you get it free with a phone. I've just got a phone, so I will try it.
Metropolitan media elite.
No, I tell you what I think. You underestimate Apple at your peril. I think it's more akin to Amazon because it owns all of these devices. And now if you have a smart TV, it's obviously going to be embedded. Of course, they're not going to get everything right. But do I think they've got the deep pockets to challenge Netflix, although Netflix is very hard to challenge? Yes, I do. And it's only one of a number that's coming over the hill. And they all need, all these big global companies seem to think they really, really need to be in stream television. And that's what's happening.
If they really think it's important to their business, they will buy a massive studio to do it properly.
Look at these two, Steve, trying to opine when you've won the quiz. Congratulations.
I'm just sitting in my triumphant glory.
You're the winner. That is it for today. Thank you to Steve Ackerman, Maggie Brown and Matt Deegan. If you like what we're up to here on the Media Podcast and you want to help us keep doing it, then do consider taking out a voluntary subscription. We do not have deep pockets like Apple. Head to themediapodcast.com/donate and choose an amount to keep us going all year round. You can catch up with our previous episodes and get new ones as soon as they're released by subscribing for free on our website, themediapodcast.com. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer, Rebecca Grisdale-Sherry, and the Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.